Good evening and welcome back to AM 800 WRTH, broadcasting live out of... And we just got off Skype with Tony, who gave us a fascinating rundown of the ghost stories in Botswana. Now, turning to the phone lines, it looks like... Oh my God, it's Sean from Kentucky calling in again. Sean, you're on the air with WRTH, are you okay?
Yes, but after that last phone call, I took the dogs to a nearby hotel. I had to spend a couple nights there. I just need to get away from a bit.
What happened? We got cut off. I've been worried about you ever since. Man, I've got people here at the station trying to track you down just so I know you're okay. I came downstairs and the dogs were going crazy. They were barking and jumping on one of those back windows that looks out into the forest. They were going at it so hard I had to physically pull them away because I was terrified they were going to break through the glass. As I was pulling them away, I heard something outside. Loud enough I could hear it over there, racket. Sean, before you say anything further, can I tell you what I heard over the phone? It might corroborate with your experience. Yes, please. I want to know if it matches what happened. I heard a low growl, and it got louder over a second or two, like a wild animal? I thought it might be one of your dogs, but it sounded like a huge dog, like a mastiff or something. A big dog, right? Maybe 5 foot tall at the shoulder, even taller from the ground to his head, absolutely covered in fur with a mane around his head. Well, that's not exactly what I pictured, but with paws the size of my hands and a head bigger than mine, with green glowing eyes that I could see through the window, eyes that cut through the darkness that I've seen in my dreams for the last 4 days. My God, is that what you saw?
I thought it was a bear.
But a bear doesn't look like that. Bears don't have manes. No, this was a dog. Positive was the same dog I saw last week sitting in front of my side window. The silhouette would be right, and the height, well, it looked big when it was sitting down, but it was massive when it was standing on its four legs. It just stared at me. Through me, I caught a flash of something else in the window. Just as I saw it, Rusty pulled me backwards and I fell over her. When I got back up, there was nothing outside, and Stephanie was gone. You saw Stephanie again? I sure did, reflected in the window, but just for a second. And then I fell. After I got off the floor, I looked back out the window and back to where she was, but there wasn't anything. The dogs immediately started to calm down, pacing around the area where I saw her and whimpering. It's like they were looking for her, but that's just it. I don't think that animal outside was looking at me. I think it was looking at Stephanie. What happened after that? Well, I packed a few things, called a couple of hotels, and found a motel in town that would let me have my dogs there. I was so happy when I parked in the garage because I didn't have to go outside to get the car. The dogs and I left that night, and I only got back yesterday. The morning after we left, I called my boss and I told him I wouldn't be in that day. I needed to figure out what to do about the dogs, and I couldn't just leave them at the hotel. So I brought my laptop with me, and I checked my email at work. I had a message from that co-worker I told you about, the one who told me about the house and its name. Apparently she listens to your show, and she recognized my voice. Well, she wanted me to call her because she said there was someone I needed to talk to, and it had to do with what was happening at the house. Well, did you? Yeah, I replied to her and called her on her lunch hour. She was kind of freaking out on the phone. Kept asking if I was okay, if the dogs were okay. Then she said I needed to talk to her friend, who, for lack of a better name, I'll just call her Barbara.
Barbara, and who's that?
Well, apparently they've been friends since high school, and after figuring out I was calling into your show, my co-worker called her friend. Barbara's lived here most of her life, too, and then... She was
probably Stephanie's only friend in elementary school.
What?
Barbara used to play with Stephanie at school, and they became friends. I called her, and she asked if I could meet her at the coffee shop. We met at my favorite one in the middle of the town, and honestly, she filled in a lot of the holes.
How so?
Well, Barbara and Stephanie started hanging out together because Barbara felt bad for her. The entire school knew what happened to her parents, and Stephanie always seemed distant. Maybe a little weird. She kept to herself. Usually played alone during recess, and even then, mostly bouncing a ball against the wall of the school on her own. Barbara asked if she could play with her, and they started talking. Barbara would walk her home, and they lived right down the street, maybe half a mile away. She said she always had this weird feeling whenever she went near the house. She was inside only once when her family dropped off some Christmas presents. Delilah was nice. She wanted to assure me of this, but she was overprotective. Looking back on it, she thinks Delilah was devastated by the loss of her daughter and son-in-law, and she wanted to make sure Stephanie never put herself in any kind of danger. Stephanie told her that she liked to play in the forest, but her grandma wanted to make sure she could always see her. If she wandered too far, she'd get in trouble.
That's kind of sad, really.
Well, Barbara wasn't done. She said Stephanie was always a little strange. She figured it was because of the loss of her parents, but she told me something that made the hair on the back of my neck stand up.
What was that?
One time at school, Stephanie told her about her playmate. Someone she played with at home, and she'd always get in trouble because they'd go off into the forest and have adventures, and Grandma would get real mad. Delilah never punished her when this happened, not really. But she wouldn't be allowed to go outside again until tomorrow. Barbara thought she was talking about an imaginary friend because there really wasn't anyone around Tanglewood Hill she could go play with. Occasionally, Barbara would play with her at the house, but it was always out front. Never in the house, never in the woods. Then my coworker told her about what had been happening at the house, and well, there were tears in Barbara's eyes. She explained to me what Stephanie had told her about. The floof, man. That's what she called her imaginary friend. Remember from the diary, the floof? She brought it up a few times at school, but the story was usually the same. She got in trouble because she was playing with the floof and they went too far out into the woods again. I asked her about the floof. She told Stephanie said it was her dog, but Stephanie didn't have a dog. She kind of called her on that, and Stephanie would be adamant that the floof lived in the forest, and Stephanie thought she looked more floofy than fluffy, as she put it, so she called him the floof. When Barbara asked about the dog, Stephanie said he was a big dog with billowing fur that blew in the wind, a huge mane around its head, and,
my God,
eyes that glowed as green as the forest.
You mean...
She described the thing I saw through the window. I've never talked to her before in my life. Even my coworker didn't know anything about it. The thing I saw through the window matched the description of Stephanie's playmate years ago.
That's insane. That's incredible.
I asked her if she wanted me to come over, if she wanted to come over and take a look at the house. Maybe she'd spot something I wouldn't, something that might lead to some more answers. She agreed, and we met there a few minutes later. We walked around back, and I showed her, where I saw the floof. There were no tracks. There's no trace of anything. An animal that big should have left some kind of imprint on the soft ground, but there wasn't anything there. I opened the door, and we walked inside. She and I went through each room, and I showed her where I found the diary, and I even let her read it. After a few minutes, she looked up from the book, looked around her, and asked if I heard that. I did. I heard footsteps walk down the hall and stop at the door of my office. I heard it just as well as I hear you over the phone. I didn't say anything because I didn't want to scare her, but Barbara wasn't scared. He walked over to the door and looked out in the hall. Nothing there. No one's around. It's just me, her, and the dogs. He made a left turn and went one room down, stopping in front of my guest bedroom.
This was Stephanie's room, she said.
She used to throw small stones at it to get her attention. Barbara looked around, and then she did something I don't quite understand.
What was that?
She started talking, not to me, but to Stephanie, kind of like I did that one night. She said hello. She said she missed her. She said that after all these years, she finally believed her stories about the floof. She told her she had kids of her own, the same age they were when they first met, and how she wished Stephanie was around to meet him. And when she finished, she turned back around to me, and there was a big smile on her face. We wandered back downstairs where she hugged me and thanked me for showing her the house. She'd always wanted to see it. Before she left, she said, "This is your place now. This is your home. You should try talking to them. Maybe they can tell you something to bring them some peace. Maybe there's something they want." She shrugged and got in her car and drove away. I went inside thinking about what she'd said, and that's when I had a realization that made me lean against the wall because I almost fell down. Something they want. You heard it. I heard it. It was written on the walls of my office. It was written in my notebook. Man, she wants to go play. You mean the locked doors, the boxes blocking the doors, the voices, that thing outside the window. Stephanie wants to go play and Delilah is stopping her. You hear that, Delilah? She wants to go play. She wants to go play with her friend, damn it. Sean, do you think that's... Stephanie, listen to me, honey. You can go out and play. Delilah, there's nothing that can hurt her now. It's okay. She's okay. She's got a friend out there in the trees, and he misses her. This is my house now, you two, and I'm getting sick of you locking me inside and locking Stephanie inside. I'm opening every damn door in this house, Stephanie. You go play, sweetie. Floop is out there, and he's waiting for you. I bet he's right outside. I bet he's... Oh, my God, he is. He's... Damn it, Delilah! Come on now. Be free, alone forever? Whoa, 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 wait a sec, big fella. Just a sec.
In the 1986 movie Crocodile Dundee, Sue, a photojournalist on assignment in Australia, starts to take a picture of a young Indigenous Australian man. He stops her saying, "Oh no, you can't take my photograph." Sue smiles and says, "Oh, because you believe it'll take your spirit away." "Nah," he replies, "you've got a lens cap on." But the notion of a camera stealing a person's soul isn't a foreign concept to some of the Indigenous Australians, nor is it unheard of in parts of Mexico and Central America. When this notion arises in a movie, it's often as a semi-disparaging joke, something that calls attention to a person or a people with outdated beliefs and awkward sensibilities. We understand the camera merely captures light, light as it exists at a certain time and in a certain way. You could say it preserves a memory. It's releasing it from a flowing time stream and placing it into its own current, where it could be viewed later. But if a camera doesn't capture a piece of one's soul, why is it that we so often have trouble throwing away photographs? Why do we spend so much time saving them, sorting them, backing them up on Apple and Google Photos, some people going so far as to make sure we have redundant backups of their photographs? Sure, we've already taken 23 photos of Cousin Sarah at the park today, but this one, IMG00024.jpg, no, that one is special. Photos are more than data or colors on paper. They can evoke a feeling. They can return you to another time, placing you back when that thing happened, where it all began, or perhaps where it all ended. Pictures are powerful, and they're supposedly worth 1,000 words. But for now, Here's 1,506 words on a paranormal video game series where photography is the only thing that protects you, and it's your only weapon against the darkness, against the ghosts. Welcome to the survival horror world of Fatal Frame. Fatal Frame, called Zero in Japan and Project Zero in Europe, is a paranormal survival horror series like no other. For the unfamiliar, a survival horror video game is one in which you are usually a lone protagonist, battling against the forces of darkness. What those forces are, well, that varies from game to game. In Resident Evil, you're fighting zombies and monsters. In Silent Hill, you're facing down otherworldly horrors, but there's a twist to this game, and that's where it gets its name. In a survival horror game, you are hopelessly outnumbered, completely outmatched, and you are well and truly on your own. Even in games where you have teammates, characters struggling with you against the gloom, well, that doesn't matter. You're still going to be a small band in a dark world, and your odds of survival aren't great. Resident Evil set out a template for survival horror that carried over to many games in the genre. Weapons are rare. Ammunition is available, but never in great quantities. You will need to count each bullet, making sure you don't run out. Chances are, you're still going to run out of ammunition. Items that restore your health are not only limited, but for the best effects, you'll need to find and combine a variety of them. And when it comes to saving your game, you can only do so in certain places where there's a typewriter. Even worse, you need another item, a typewriter ribbon, to save your game. You can make great headway and then find yourself sweating it out because while you know you can find the closest typewriter, you're all out of ribbons. In the world of Fatal Frame, many of these ideas carry over. The entirety of the game's world is against you. A helpful item is rare, and you cherish them when you find them. You can save your game only in certain locations, but when it comes to weapons, that's where we come to the unique nature of the game. Your weapon is a camera. Your ammunition is film. And that is it. There aren't any guns, no bullets, no baseball bats with nails driven through them. There are no 2x4s or golf clubs or chainsaws or anything like that. After all, they wouldn't be all that useful against ghosts anyway. Because that's the nature of Fatal Frame. Your antagonists are ghosts. Some of them are gentle, non-combative spirits that wander the dark locations sprawled out over 7 games as of 2020. But most of them are out to get you, to bring you over to their side so that you may join the ranks of the restless dead. You have one weapon against them, the only thing that drives them back and exorcises them permanently. The camera obscura. But before we look down the lens of the camera, let's talk a bit about the game. With its roots firmly in Japanese horror, the ghosts of Fatal Frame aren't quite the kind you'd see in the standard Western spook story. Within the theatrical traditions of no and kabuki, Japanese specters tend to be out for revenge, actively seeking retribution upon the living. To compare cultures, a ghostly tale from England may involve the spirit of a woman haunting a countryside manor. She can be heard and seen, wandering the hallways, weeping over her betrayal by the man who loved her, got her pregnant, and then killed her to cover up his illegitimate child. Meanwhile, such a story in Japanese folklore may play out in a similar way, except the woman's ghost kills any man who dares cross into her domain. She's pissed off, and she's going to do something about it. That is what you're dealing with in Fatal Frame. Within all the games, your way of fighting back is the camera obscura. Invented by Dr. Kunihiko Aso, a scientist and folklorist with an interest in the paranormal, the camera obscura not only has the ability to photograph ghosts, but also show you scenes from the past. Your character, the one that you play in the game, is often an unwilling ghost hunter who's been thrown into this situation through no real fault of their own. Most of the games are played in a third-person view, with the sort of game depicting you from a stationary point in a location. However, when you use the camera, you're taken into a first-person view. But unlike a first-person shooter, all you have is the viewfinder of the camera obscura. If the ghost happens to be a passive spirit, perhaps a residual haunting, you can capture them on film. In this way, you can exorcise that ghost and help it move on. While you don't exactly have to do this, it certainly helps you learn more about the story. Knowledge is power, and it's dangerous to go alone. Take pics. Of course, when faced with a hostile entity, the camera is your weapon, and for taking pictures of ghosts, it's the only way to hurt them. The camera obscura isn't exactly a DSLR. It's a film-based camera, and you'll need film to use it. Guess what is also in short supply in the game? And here's where that weapon mechanic comes in, if you could even call it that. Some film is better than others and does more damage. But for the best results, you want to capture an image of the ghost at exactly the right time, at a point in its attack where it's the weakest. Snapping a picture at that point does more damage than a standard shot. It'll knock the ghost back, and it'll allow you to chain shots together for even more damage. Sort of like a burst mode, in a way. This point of weakness occurs for only a second or so, and you have to watch carefully through your viewfinder to catch it. And it's from this chance that the game gets its name, because that moment is the fatal frame for that spirit. But let's circle back, because look at what we're using to strike down vengeful ghosts. A camera. In the world of Fatal Frame, the camera does steal a piece of the soul. That's why it hurts the ghosts. But it goes beyond that. You also release some of the ghosts from their pain, sending them over to the other side. The flash of your camera brings relief and release just as much as it protects you. Fatal Frame is dark, both in its atmosphere and in its story. And if anything is certain, it's that almost nobody is getting out alive. The great thing about each game is that they're only loosely connected. You could pick up any game in the series and just dive in, without worrying about what happened before or after, for that matter, since the games don't really take place in chronological order anyway. Honestly, if you're going to give the series a try, I recommend starting with Fatal Frame 2, Crimson Butterfly. It's usually credited as being the best in the series, and I tend to agree. The game immediately takes you by the hand and leads you down into a lost village where the memories of the past, along with the spirits, have a story to tell. And I thank you for listening to my story. This is AM 800 WRTH. And good night.